to the previously recorded radio shows that are on our website. It's going to start a little late. I had to reboot some stuff here. But so the Shroud of Turin was a piece of cloth that is very, very well known as being very, very legitimate. There's so much information and so many facts that, you know, facts and evidence, I would call it, that prove the Shroud of Turin is real, that it, I'm going to see if I can get to some of this here for you. that prove Shroud of Turin is real. Okay, let's see if we can find something cool here. It continues to elude science, okay? So, and then, okay, now here's fake news, you know. Somebody goes in and they test the shroud for carbon-14 dating, and they cut a little piece off of part of the shroud, which they were told specifically was added later by nuns or someone in the convent where it had been torn. The Shroud of Turin survived a fire, and it is basically what I believe and what it's claimed to believe is that it was the cloth that covered Jesus Christ when he was resurrected. So if you look at it, his whole body, his whole impression is irradiated into the cloth, okay? This has never happened before or since, number one. Okay, so when people say, oh, no, it's this or it's that, it's like, okay, interesting, great, awesome theory. If it's this or that, why has it never happened before or since? Okay, number one. That's kind of important factuality, correct? I mean, if it doesn't happen, I mean, if it's only happened once, why in the world would it not be what it's claimed to be? The Catholic Church has had it around for a very long time, claiming specifically that that's what it is, which, you know, that's probably a pretty good indicator that they might know what they're talking about. There's different things on it. There's actual blood on it. There's exactly within detail, within excruciating detail, the whippings and the beatings and the floggings that he took, you know, in great detail. And it's interesting because you have the outline of a man, and it shows that the man had been whipped and beaten. It shows the nail holes in his feet, the nail holes in his hands, everything. And then, of course, there's the non-believing public, we'll call them, that wants to always refute it. But it is, I think it's a gift that was left behind by Jesus. And he talks about, interestingly enough, people talk about, you know, why did Jesus fold up his you know, whatever it was, garment when he was resurrected. And there's people that get into the actual etiquette of the time. Okay, and there was meaning of the folded napkin in Jesus's tomb. Okay, now there's people that have, you know, truth or fiction, and, you know, or this kind of stuff. But is there significance to the fact that he folded his linen burial cloth? And for there's people that claim that when someone folded their burial cloth, they were finished. I heard someone claiming it the other way, which, you know, I don't know. You can get into all kinds of debates over that. People that say if they were really satisfied with the meal, they'd wad it up and there was people saying he was, you know, he was offended. And so the information that's come that I've seen would imply, you know, in that for the here's something that I'll read that, you know, may or may not apply. It says, for the past 2,000 years, the meaning of this text, which is my basic conviction, is that God has given us all we need to understand in the Bible, all the necessary information in the Bible itself and the Holy Spirit who illuminates. So in 1 Corinthians 2, it says, when I came to you, brothers and sisters, I did not come with superior eloquence or wisdom as I proclaimed the testimony of God, for I decided to be concerned about nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and with much trembling. My conversation and my preaching were not with persuasive words and so on and so forth. That's Paul. He said, and it says, can a knowledge of the original languages of the Bible history be helpful at times? Well, the answer is, of course, yes. That's why I'm always going to the Hebrew and the Greek. Are they so essential to an understanding of the Bible so that only the elite, now here we go, who possess these abilities can know what God's word means?
No.
Okay, so you can read God's word when it's translated into English. Do you miss a lot? Yes. If you're not digging into the Hebrew or the Greek, I'm going to be honest. Since I started reading the Hebrew and the Greek, I mean, I have like grown and grown and grown in knowledge, just blown my mind, to be honest with you. Absolutely blown my mind at the meaning and the extensiveness of like the Greek language at the time. It was phenomenally deep. I've been told they had 7 to 26 times the words we do. So they were over, you know, that. So it says, the information that's come your way would imply too much for me to accept, blah, blah, blah. For the past 2,000 years, the meaning of this text and of the folded cloth in particular has been hidden from the eyes of all but those few Jews who understand the culture and customs of that day. It says, and thus can understand what God wanted us to know from this detail. And then it says in parentheses, this assumes that this was a part of the culture and customs of that day, something I'm not inclined to accept, he said, without verification. So then he said, the same sort of reasoning takes place, in my opinion, when Jewish Christians perform Passover, Seder. They take the rituals orally preserved, and he goes on and on and on and on and on. And he explains that the I'm coming back theme is certainly true and is dependent upon the folded cloth, okay? So what they say is that it used to be that if you went to somebody's house and you had dinner, okay, and you were going to go to the bathroom or something, you would fold your cloth up and you would put it on the table or wherever, okay? If you were done eating, you would wad your cloth up and you would throw it, you know, away. Well, the Bible is very clear that Jesus took the time to fold his cloth up. And why? Because he was coming back. And it talks, you know, when we go back where it says, for I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you, for that the Lord Jesus on the night on which he was betrayed took bread, and after that he gave thanks and broke it and said, this is my body which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. In the same way he also took the cup, and it goes on and on. This is my blood. Do this every time. For every time you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. So he says, anyway, he goes into the whole thing of the Mishnah, the story of the Mishnah, which says these are the, you know, it goes into details of, the Mishnah talks about, I don't want to get too deep into this, but it talks about how to handle a cloth when you eat. The napkin issue it talks about was how to, it was to be placed, a summary of points of contention you know, between rabbis. It talks about how to place it on the table or a cushion. The reference to the napkin's placement was before and during the meal and not afterwards. The critical discussion concerning the meal's end, et cetera, et cetera. So basically, that part of the scripture, in my opinion, has meaning. Jesus folded it up and laid it aside for a purpose, to say, I will come back. He didn't exactly have, you know, you weren't folding cloths all the time. So it was, it was fairly significant, you know. So that just the fact that the Shroud of Turin exists, it was a gift from us. It has, we have 3D capabilities now of the image. The image of the man on the shroud can be read by 3D imaging technology now. Paintings fail this test, okay? So you cannot paint what is on the shroud. You cannot paint what is on the shroud. So you can forget that theory. I don't know how many of you even know what I'm talking about. I hope you do. The image was just is irradiated into this cloth. The image is not a stain. It's not painted on the shroud. It's not burned on in a conventional heat application method. Instead, it is seared onto the cloth with a, now listen to this, with a technology which it says A, has yet to be explained, and B, which we do not currently have at our possession. So however that image got onto the Shroud of Turin was done with a technology that we don't have, okay? So I think when Jesus was resurrected, I think that there was a flash, an amazing flash. I think that God, something happened, and it was wow, right? It was wow, boom. You know, there was some kind of a huge flash. God brought Jesus back to life. He may have been transformed. Who knows exactly what happened, but we don't have that technology even today. Not only can scientists and historians not produce this type of an image using any type of technology, especially medieval technologies, they cannot reproduce it with any type of modern technology. Now, Italian scientist Paolo blah blah, okay, I'll say De Lazzaro to sound more professional, tried for 5 years to replicate the image and concluded it was produced by ultraviolet light, but that the ultraviolet light necessary to reproduce the image exceeds the maximum power released by all of the ultraviolet light sources on Earth today at the same exact time. In such, it says, in such a quick and yet cool fashion without the heat. Something we don't, the, folks, this tells us something about our God, doesn't it? Wow, right? It says, it exceeds maximum power release, blah, blah, blah. The time for such a burst would be shorter than 1/40 billionth of a second. And the intensity of the ultraviolet light would have to be several billion watts. So then the second issue of contention and proof and evidence support is the 3D capabilities of the image. The image of the man on the shroud can be read by 3D imaging technology. What this means is, okay, if you have a shroud or a piece of cloth, you can paint or, you know, impose things on it, but it's going to impose in a two-dimensional fashion. This is done three-dimensionally. It also talks us, it talks about the wounds of the crucified man are all just extraordinarily consistent, not only with Roman crucifixion, but with the specific details of Jesus' particular crucifixion. The scourging, the crown of thorns, no broken bones, the wound in the side. In addition, medieval paintings show the nails in the path of Christ's hands. The shroud shows the nail wounds in his wrists, which is anatomically correct. The flesh of the palms would not have supported the weight of the man's body. Oh, I think most people understand that now. When they crucified people, they hung them from a tree. Very brutal, brutal, torturous method of death. But they pounded the nails through the wrist. Your hands would rip right out. And yikes, right? The number four kind of evidentiality is geography. Pollen from the shroud is not only from the Jerusalem area, but from Turkey and other places the shroud is supposed to have resided over the years. Dust from the area of the image by the knees and feet is from the area around Jerusalem. The evidence of Jewish burial customs is number five. The shroud details are perfectly consistent with first century Jewish burial customs. This is what I was getting into earlier. There are even microscopic traces. This is the part that's kind of cool. There are even microscopic traces of the flowers, okay, real flowers. There's microscopic traces of the flowers that would have been used in the burial. Flowers that grew locally and were known to be used for burial only. In addition, traces of the spices used for Jewish burial have also been discovered on the shroud. Folks, I think you're getting the point, and I don't want to, you know, bore you, but this is the real deal. I think it's a gift left behind by God. It's proof of Jesus' resurrection. We have proof of his resurrection right here. The type of cloth, okay, the blood in the image. The blood stains on the shroud are real human blood, not paint, okay? The flow of the blood accurately reflects crucifixion and subsequent burial. The image was seared on the linen. Now think about it. The image was seared on the linen after the blood stains. The fact that the blood stains retain their reddish color is evidence that the blood came from a person under extreme duress. The most recent finding again suggests the crucified man was tortured. And Lucifer had his hour with Jesus, let's face it. It was, you know, I say had his hour. Only do I wish it was only an hour. Folks, they would take these people and get them. I mean, you just start with being as thirsty as you've ever been. You will get no water. You will get no food. You will be beaten and flogged and whipped. And, you know, every square inch of your body will just be destroyed. And where they got these people, you know, like, where do you come up with people that are willing to do this for a living? I don't know. I can't tell you. So the type of cloth, the cloth on the shroud is consistent with fabrics from first century Israel, but not with medieval Europe. And the reason I say that is some guy in the 70s tried to, you know, disprove it, and he cut a piece from, you know, that had been repaired. By the way, I don't know, I want to use the term nuns. I could be dead wrong. Somebody in the Catholic Church had actually repaired a part of the shroud and with such exquisite detail. I say another divine intervention. With such exquisite detail under high power magnification, it's basically undetectable. So they, of course, cut a piece from the corner that they know had been repaired and say, see, the carbon 14 dating brings it back to the 1500s, so you're wrong. No, they're wrong. The type of cloth that was used is consistent with fabrics from first century Israel, but in no way is it consistent with fabrics from medieval Europe. A forger would have had not he would have had to not only forge the image, but he would have had to have detailed knowledge of the linen weaves of the first century, and then not only be able to reproduce it, but then age it convincingly. We are not obligated to believe in the shroud. Okay, you're not obligated. Your salvation doesn't depend on it at all. It's undeniably mysterious. Having said that, okay, having said that, knowledge of the shroud is mysterious knowledge. It increases, in my opinion, the likelihood of its reality. So we're not obliged to believe in the shroud. It's undeniably mysterious. Having said that, it's also mysterious how dismissive the skeptics, most skeptics are. They just blow this off. Now think about it. You have proof. You potentially have proof that Jesus Christ lived, died, was crucified exactly as the Bible said, and then was resurrected with some kind of a ultraviolet light explosion that lasted 1/440 billionth of a second. I mean, what is that? I mean, what, does that tell us more about the universe? I don't know, but I can tell you it's something. It means something. Okay, so the forger would have to have had a lot of knowledge, right? And he would have had to have detailed knowledge of the linen weaves, etc. And so we're not obliged to believe in the shroud. It is undeniably mysterious. Having said that, it's also mysterious how dismissive the skeptics are. I know I'm repeating myself, but I'm just going back through this article. They cry out for scientific evidence. They're always crying out for scientific evidence. They, prove it, prove it, prove it. I've heard people say, if Jesus came down and stood before me right now and performed a miracle, I'd believe. Well, I'm sorry, he already tried that. So they're always crying out for scientific evidence. But when the evidence is produced, few will even take the time to examine it closely. Now, please understand, this is evidence. The Shroud of Turin is a gift from God showing proof, absolute proof. Again, everything that God does always leaves a flare of faith in order to believe it. He just always does. He always leaves it that way. And so they cry out for scientific evidence. When the evidence is produced, they don't examine it closely. They simply shrug and say, well, we just don't know. Nothing has been proven. All we have is an old cloth for which there's no explanation as of yet. One of the principles of creative skepticism is that the obvious answer is usually the right one. I think that's Occam's razor. I think it is. They basically say when there's a crime and you're investigating it, the most logical explanation is usually the right explanation, the one that, just not good. Not good at all. So, you got that. You've got the Shroud of Turin. You've got evidence, in my opinion. So, one of the principles of creative skepticism is that the obvious answer is usually the right one. Okay, that's Occam's razor. And you know, folks, if you want to be wise and you're afraid someone's lying, a couple things. One is if what they're saying is very confusing, yeah, they're probably lying. And two, the obvious answer is usually the right one. So many people get ripped off. You know, we deal with it all the time. We hear stories of people getting their jewelry or their coins stolen. And I'm always like, did you have workers in the house recently? Well, yeah, we had someone redoing the brick or whatever. You got to be really careful about that stuff because those people will come back and rip you off. Or, you know, so many times when people get ripped off, I'll say, who do you think did it? And they'll say, well, I don't know. And I'll say, yeah, you do. Who do you think did it? They'll say, well, there's this neighbor boy, but the police won't pursue him. Well, of course the police won't pursue him because, you know, they wouldn't, they have rights and all that. But in all reality, the police should probably go do a better job of investigation. But the laws protect the criminals now, not the victims. So the obvious answer is that the Shroud of Turin is the burial cloth of Jesus Christ. I personally believe that it is 100% authentic. There's no doubt in my mind, okay? I went to an amazing thing. I've seen it. Well, I didn't see it. I went to a big thing on it. If skeptics come up with a convincing answer to the questions of the Shroud, the questions that the Shroud presents, I am wide open-minded. I'm open-minded just like I am about the economic issues we face. I have challenged people over and over. Prove to me we're not going to blow sky high financially. I'm open. Teach me. Tell me. You know, and no one yet has taken me up on it because it's simple mathematics. I think people just don't realize how long it's going to last and when it ends, how bad it's going to be. So I believe the Shroud's authentic. If skeptics come up with a convincing theory of what it is, I'm open-minded. My faith is rooted in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, not in the Shroud, okay? But I think the Shroud is great evidence. The fact that the Shroud remains a mystery is a reminder of the other verse from the New Testament that says we walk by faith and not by sight. And it is ironic that no matter what Jesus does, there's always an element of faith. You know, folks, what a complex system. What an amazing system. Everything is faith. You've got to have faith. It's important that you have faith. You got to have it. I mean, you got to have it in order to believe in Jesus, don't you? But at the same time, when you begin to live by faith, now people will say, I actually had a guy come in the shop one time. I had just finished a show. A heathen. Non-believer came in the shop, and what did he have? He had all this garbage literature, okay? Just a bunch of trash, and it didn't apply. It was just a bunch of junk. So I just went to personal testimony, because testimony is usually the most powerful. And he said, well, I believe. I said, don't you believe that? He said, well, I believe that you believe that those things happen in your life, but I don't believe they did. So he was basically telling me that what I personally experienced as a human being was just a fantasy, was all conveniently lodged in my mind as an occurrence that never happened. It was all perspective, okay? But in most cases, people will respect your personal testimony. You cannot answer every question. One thing that's very frustrating is there is no end to people trying to pick apart the Bible. There's no end to it at all. And what's even worse is people that think they're highly intellectual will take that stuff and they'll read, you know, philosophy. And I've been through all this stuff in college and I know people that are going through the same thing. The question is, do you want to believe the truth or do you want to believe a lie? And that, my friends, is what it boils down to, in my opinion. You need to make a decision today. Either Jesus is real or he's not. He claims he was. He lived. There's no doubt he lived. I've even heard modern day fools say, well, there's no evidence that he lived. It's a fairy tale. This is how far we've gone. You know, how much archaeological study do you think that you need to engage in to prove the existence of Jesus? Anybody who's even involved in archaeology has no question Jesus Christ existed. No doubt whatsoever. None. Absolutely none. Everyone knows he existed. They know he existed. There's no question whatsoever that he existed. So, you know, I guess when you get people that are maybe foolish enough to try to say he didn't, I think that's sad because, in my opinion, they are ignoring what is already obvious, okay? So we, you know, to change gears. So that's interesting stuff. Now, to change gears, I'm going to bounce around a little bit. I got some notes here, okay? Now, we had Eisenhower. Do you remember his speech on the military-industrial complex? Okay, what did he mean by that and why? You know, he took the time to give that speech. So he was worried about, let's see. I may be able to find some transcripts on that speech. And I may not, but he made it crystal clear that he wanted people to understand that there was a military-industrial complex present. And then when I look at the speech, it's pretty long. He says, "My fellow Americans, 3 days from now, after half a century of service to our country, I shall lay down the responsibilities of office in tradition and solemn ceremony. The authority of president is vested in my successor. This evening I come to you with a message of leave taking and farewell, and to share a few final thoughts with you, my countrymen." This is Eisenhower. "Like every other citizen, I wish the new president and all who will labor with him Godspeed. I pray that the coming years will be blessed with peace and prosperity for all." And I pray the same for you all, too, that hear this. Peace and prosperity. And, folks, prosperity is something, don't be afraid to pray for it. I pray for prosperity for each and every one of you. Jesus wants us to have prosperity, and he wants us to have peace. He really does. He wants us to live a life of peace and prosperity. It's very important that we live peace and prosperity. He says, "Our new people expect their president and Congress to find essential agreement." Oh, yeah. "On issues of great moment, the wise resolution of which will better shape the future of the nation." I have a funny feeling that at the time of Eisenhower, the vitriol, the hatred, the animosity, the contention was nowhere near where we are today. Would you agree? I would assume if you know much about our history and our current condition, you'd probably have to agree. He said, our people expect us essentially at this great moment to, you know, shape a better nation. My own relationships with the Congress, which began on a remote and tenuous basis when long ago a member of the Senate appointed me to the West Point, I have since ranged to the intimate during the war and immediate post-war period, and finally to the mutually independent during these past 8 years. In this final relationship, the Congress and the administration have, on most vital issues, cooperated well to serve the national good rather than mere partisanship. Now, that's where we've changed. And so I've assured that the business of the nation should go forward. Okay? So all these threats by, like, Chuck Schumer and all this to shut the government down. And by the way, with this midterm election loss of Congress, first of all, expect it. Secondly, oh no, we are in a freezer box. We will now begin to see the dirtiest, nastiest politics you've ever seen. We're going to see accusations against Trump. They're going to try to impeach him. It's just going to be ugly. Folks, I believe that Donald J. Trump is a pure man, okay? What do I mean by that? I've discussed it. No skeletons in the closet, no baggage, no old drug problems. His weakness, yeah, he liked women. You know, that there's a sin there, of course. But my point is that he wasn't a man filled with sin and corruption and deception. They would have found that out about him. He is what he is, what he is. What you see is what you get with Donald J. Trump. That's why he's been able to survive this onslaught of this Robert Mueller Russia collusion trash. And you and I both know it's just garbage. Everyone should know it's total trash. It's all a way for them to take to deflect any focus off of anything positive that he may accomplish while in office, which is a darn shame, okay? He says, we now stand, the final relationship, he talks about Congress and most vital issues cooperated well and to serve the national good rather than mere partisanship, and he assured the business of the nation will go forward, and he says, we now stand 10 years past the midpoint of a century that has witnessed four major wars among great nations. War, war, war. And folks, fiat currency fuels war. Remember that. Fiat currency fuels war. It's designed for war. Why? Number one, they can have all the cash they want. Number two, who gives them the cash? The bank. Who gets paid back? The bank. What side does the bank loan to? Both sides. The bank doesn't care. They loan and they loan and they create and they loan and they create. So please understand that we are in a position where the fiat currency system of this nation is going to generate and create war at a level that will never cease. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. The problem is we're going to poke the bear. I believe, first of all, economically, we are at the fringe's end, okay? America is absolutely bankrupt, you know, and there's plenty of reasons why. So why is America bankrupt? I mean, we are bankrupt beyond your wildest dreams. We're bankrupt. We've got deficits and debts and individual ridiculous, I won't, you know, get into it so much, but we're bankrupt. Republicans couldn't care less. I mean, I'm sorry. I hate to say it, but the real Republican platform, which has been rejected by everybody, but maybe the John Birch Society, which is now considered right-wing radical fruitcake nut jobs, okay? Everybody but them knows we're bankrupt. We are bankrupt. Done. Over. It's over. Our debt is insurmountable. It's untouchable. They say within the next 7 or 8 years, the interest alone will consume every dollar of revenue. Think about that. Just the interest will consume every penny of revenue. Okay. So what does that mean? What that means is prepare yourself for a big whammy of a war. Okay. The problem is you are going to see China and Russia come together and become allies even more so, even with like North Korea and so on and so forth, that is going to head us into deeper and deeper trouble. This country, America, is we are fully and effectively bankrupt, okay? That doesn't matter to the GOP. That's the grand old party, the conservatives, the Republicans. They don't care, okay? Once evangelists of fiscal responsibility, that's the Republicans, and scourges of deficit spending. Don't you love it when Obama was in office, the Republicans hated debt? Now Republicans glory in spilling red ink, just spewing the money out like crazy. The national deficit is hitting $21 trillion, and maybe more. When I, you know, every time I turn around, it's higher. It's greater than the annual GDP, okay, the annual gross domestic product, which means, okay, it's greater than the annual GDP of about $19.5 trillion. With Republicans at the helm, deficits are set to continue racing upwards without any end, okay? So where we're at, we are in big trouble. I'll just put it that way. The flood of red ink will increase. Last year, the Congressional Budget Office figured the U.S. was going to again run trillion-dollar deficits around 2022. An extra $10 trillion will be added by the deficit over the next six or seven years of Trump's reign, okay? That's a problem. But under Republican fiscal stewardship, an analyst now believes the deficit could hit $1 trillion next year. Why? Congress relaxed the sequester, eliminating its modest pressure for fiscal responsibility, and they approved disaster relief without making any corresponding spending cuts. Legislators also inflated military outlays, even though much of the Pentagon budget constitutes defense, welfare, subsidies for prosperous and populous allies. So our money's going to other people around the world. What we need to understand when we talk about this is the fact that the spending is out of control. It's just that simple, folks. And just to keep it simple for you, what I want you to do is to understand deeply, deeply, deeply. You need to preserve your assets, okay? You've got to have gold. There is no other way. You've got to have precious metals-based assets, okay? Our economy is stressed. It is not doing great. It's stressed. What's happening is we're pumping tons of debt into it, which is deceiving everybody. Everybody's cost of living is going up while their actual income is not. It's a total trickery. It's deception. I don't know where Donald Trump falls into this stuff. I don't know how much he knew coming in. He may have known a heck of a lot more than we're discussing, because they say that Donald Trump used to listen to just about anybody. And not that he was a fool, but he would, you know, he let the politicians push and push and push. Okay? So the last time the deficit ran this high was, of course, 2012. Which was part of a four-year trillion-dollar-plus spending run in the aftermath of the financial crisis and ensuing bailout tsunami. Last year's Congressional Budget Office assessment was sobering enough. Deficits were supposed to rise due to accelerating Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid spending, and rising interest costs on the growing debt, accompanied by only by modern growth in revenue collection, which is taxes. And Obama increased that by 100%, and it's done us no good. So I could keep going on and on. The numbers continue to worsen. Like I said, we're out of time. What's new? Listen, I'm going to be candid with you. I have been doing this a long time, okay? What we do here at Coins Plus, we build portfolios, okay? And what that means is you don't buy into this baloney, malarkey, where you go buy a stock and you sit and stare at it every day in the newspaper and wonder why you're not making money and get fed a line of baloney. Okay? You're buying real hard stuff. You're buying, you know, I'll tell you, when you get to collectability, even numismatic or semi-numismatic, two times during the Great Depression, collectibles went up faster than at any other time in history. And then during Nazi Germany. So humans have a desire for value built in them, okay? The Bible's crystal clear. Precious metal / gold. Second chapter of Genesis pops up out of the blue. No reason. Boom, here it is. God says, here's what's important. He uses the most complimentary Hebrew word possible. He absolutely rants and raves about how great it is. He gives it. It's the first gift. He gives his son. He showers Israel with it. When they're leaving the Exodus, he showers Israel, the country, with it. He showers Solomon with it. He builds a phenomenal temple out of it, of course, which was eventually torn down because of people's loose lips sink ships and so on and so forth. And the Babylonians took them all. And they obviously weren't too crazy about most of the Jews. There's something about Daniel, the book of Daniel. I personally believe when I picture a guy like Daniel, I used to think a little different. But now that I've seen some of the stuff he's done, I think he was a good-looking, super athletic, incredibly intelligent genius. So to keep it simple and save ourselves a little bit of time. Folks, if you have money in a 401k or IRA, you can put that into precious metals. We have Coins Plus provides the highest rated privately held depository service in the United States, okay? We've got a heck of a facility here, ground up built, number one. Number two, if you've got money in savings or whatever, let us build you portfolios. We will build you phenomenal portfolios. We're good at it. We build great ones. We're very excellent at it. Coins Plus, 444-0044. I'm just keeping it simple, folks. I'm done. I'm tired of tiptoeing around. Get off your tail and get in here and just get your savings locked up, no matter what it is. Once again, thanks for tuning in. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care. God bless. I love you. Keep praying for us. Bye-bye.